Hi, and welcome to the Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host today, Dr. Amber Luong from the McGovern Medical School of the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston. I've invited Drs. William Lee and Joe Reimer, both otolaryngologists practicing in Melbourne, Australia, to discuss their manuscript entitled The Effects of Systemic Bevacizumab, or also known as Avastin, on epistaxis-related outcomes in hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasias, a systematic review and meta-analysis from this month's edition of IFAR. So welcome, William and Joe, and thank you both for your time today to discuss the results of this systematic review and meta-analysis. But before I begin, can you give us a little background on your current clinical practice and research interest as it may pertain to this manuscript? William, I'll start with you since you're the first author.
No problems. Thank you so much, Prof. Luong. Thanks for having us on your podcast. And it's a great pleasure to be able to speak about this research. In terms of my own personal background, I'm currently in my fifth postgraduate year in Australia. Essentially, in American terms, I'm an ENT surgery resident, but we call it a registrar in Australia. I'm trying to get onto the surgical training program as we speak.
Awesome. And Joe?
Yes, I'm Joe Rimmer. I'm a rhinologist and skull-base surgeon. I trained in the UK, but I've been practicing in Melbourne for the last 11 years, and I'm also an associate professor at Monash University. So I have essentially purely rhinology-based practice with a special interest in HHT. So I manage, you know, hundreds of patients across the state and some interstate patients here in Australia with this condition.
Great. Yes, I've seen several of your other publications, so I knew you had a ton of experience managing these patients, and you've written on various different surgical approaches and now medical approaches for this treatment. So I'm really looking forward to hearing your insight on this really difficult group of people to manage in terms of epistaxis. So this is a systematic review and a meta-analysis on Avastin in the management of epistaxis in patients with HHT. So first, William, can you just give us a quick primer on HHT and Avastin and how the two may be related, why you looked at this, these two things?
So I think the whole research project came from a conversation I had with Prof. Rimmer just about the use of bevacizumab for the HHT patients that we treat. And as we're probably aware, these patients suffer from epistaxis, multiple emergency presentations, need for transfusions, and really suffer a lot from their epistaxis disease burden. So we're just having a conversation about the use of bevacizumab, and we tried to use it as a topical solution for injections and nasal sprays. And we've done a systematic review a few years ago, which failed to show any meaningful benefit from using that treatment. But from a pathophysiological basis, I think it didn't make sense that bevacizumab, an anti-angiogenic treatment, which has direct disease-modifying therapy for HHT, wouldn't really help in the realms of epistaxis. So we decided to look into systemic therapy, which we thought would have more global and better vascular penetrance or cytonasal disease. So that's sort of what started our interest in this topic.
Excellent. Joe, was the biologic already being used in Australia at the time clinically, or was it more kind of a theoretical kind of option for treatment?
No, so it has been used in Australia, probably increasingly so over the last few years, both systemically and topically and submucosally. It's obviously still off-label, so it's really still only licensed for some advanced malignancies as well as vascular ocular diseases. So it's an off-label use for HHT patients. And then it wasn't really until the second international guidelines were published in the middle of COVID in 2020, they recommended considering systemic bevacizumab for intractable epistaxis that had failed to respond to sort of more standard conservative and surgical ablative therapies. And so once that recommendation was made, although with very limited evidence to back it up, it became a little bit easier for me to refer patients onto a hematologist and specifically ask them if they would consider it.
Great. So, William, you kind of alluded to a prior study looking at intranasal or mucosal application of Avastin in HHT, but the data was mixed. Can you just give us a quick summary of those results? Were there a lot of good studies? And so it was pretty clear that that was not a good, you know, way of utilizing this medication?
Yep. So I believe that study was actually performed by a previous registrar by the name of Pat Stokes. And that was done with with Prof. Rimmer. That was published in 2017. And that did look at quite a few randomized control trials, so good quality randomized trials. And there was a variety of delivery mechanisms, whether it's sprays or submucosal injections that were assessed as well. But unfortunately, the large majority of these studies weren't able to show a meaningful benefit compared to placebo, injections of normal saline, for example. So that was the sort of key result of this systematic review.
I would just say on the basis of on one of the issues with that delivery method is that one of the recognized complications of Avastin is causing a septal perforation. It's been reported from systemic use, not topical. And certainly when people very first started injecting it into the nose, they were injecting it into the septum and they were causing septal perforations, which obviously do not help epistaxis. Right. So one of the issues with giving submucosal Avastin is that you can't inject it into the septum. You can only really inject it into the lateral nasal wall. And so you miss probably the vast majority of the bleeding lesions when you're doing it. And perhaps the only real role that it has is in reducing post-surgical neoangiogenesis, because anything that you do to the nose obviously triggers that process.
Got it. Okay. Well, that's very helpful. So let's dive into the analysis. William, can you tell us the primary and secondary endpoint that you focused on in this meta-analysis and kind of an overall finding or results from the study?
So the key thing outcome that we were trying to establish was essentially epistaxis-related outcomes on the use of bevacizumab in HHT. So the two key ones we looked at were epistaxis severity, and we looked at a variety of different measurement techniques. But the predominant score that was used was the epistaxis severity score, which uses a very complex calculation method to give a score from 1 to 10. And the second outcome was changes in hemoglobin, and that was at comparison to pre-treatment hemoglobin levels and comparing it to post-treatment levels. So those are the two primary endpoints. Secondary outcomes that were less reported were transfusion requirements, and that was packed red blood cell transfusions, as well as iron transfusions for the treatment of anemia and iron deficiency as well. So those were the main outcomes that we looked at for this study.
And so how many studies were you able to find that gave you those outcomes?
So for this study, we were very strict about the inclusion criteria. There were a lot of early case reports and mini case series that were published, as this was a developing field in the management of HHT epistaxis, but we didn't include those studies, and also studies that didn't have rigid study methodology, inclusion and exclusion criteria were not included in this paper as well. So at the end of our systematic review, we only found 10 studies, which is decent, consisting of one randomized control trial, two prospective non-comparative studies, and seven retrospective studies, which were the predominant study type.
Excellent. And about how many patients were included in these 10 studies?
Yeah, so the total pool population was 420, and the average age group was in the middle age, so 50 to 60 years old was the average age of this cohort.
Okay, and then so ultimately, what did you find after the meta-analysis?
Yeah, so for our meta-analysis, the two key findings were, number one, ESS had a mean average reduction of 3.33. So to sort of explain it in simple terms, if you had the most severe epistaxis score of 10, you can expect a reduction of your score by a third, and that's a minimum. So if you had a lesser score, then you'd have a significantly greater benefit in proportion to your original score. And the second outcome was that the hemoglobin levels actually recovered from pre-treatment levels by 2.38 grams per deciliter. And in our, essentially, we think of it as a transfusion of at least two packed red blood cells. So it's a very good benefit in terms of their hematological parameters. So those are our two key findings.
So overall, it looks like a very positive result when you treat these patients with systemic Avastin. What, going back to the epistaxis severity score, is this a subjective rating, kind of like on a VAS scale, or were there some objective data, or is it just the patients, you know, feeling like their epistaxis was not as severe? How does that scale really work?
So I think it really depends on how aware the patient is of their own condition, how much they're bleeding and the necessity of medical treatment. So okay. I've actually had a discussion with a hematologist overseas about this particular topic and how valid and reliable this is. But I would say that it is a combination of both patient-reported and clinician-reported outcomes, and essentially it's a shared conversation that can result in the calculation of the score. And it can be found online on an online calculator to put in certain parameters to calculate this score.
Excellent. So, Joe, with those results, first of all, is there some sort of MCID for either of those, I guess, for the ESS score, that this like was significantly higher?
I think I can comment on that. So I think the minimal clinically important difference is reported as 0.71.
Very small.
ESS. Yeah, it is very small. So in comparison to that, you know, the findings in this study are, you know, significantly greater than that.
Okay.
So it is quite complicated, as Will said, computer-generated score that was, it's been created and validated by a big group in the US. And it includes, as Will said, not only patient-reported outcomes, but objective measures, including number of transfusions, number of episodes of medical attention over the preceding time period. And then all of those have got sort of factorials that get added into it till they come up with a score of 10.
Wow, that's amazing. So given the background, how does this particular treatment maybe compare to other treatment options that we have?
I think it's very encouraging. Certainly studies have shown that conservative measures for mild epistaxis, conservative measures being essentially nasal moisturizing, treating the nose with great care, will help for mild epistaxis. But once these patients get into the multiple episodes a day, which many of them do, and they just sort of, they set their bar at a totally different level to the general population with how much epistaxis they will tolerate. But once patients get into that multiple episodes a day, they really do need something more than conservative measures. The epistaxis score, certainly there is a significant reduction in frequency and severity of epistaxis with laser ablation, for example, but it's not prolonged or it's not maintained. It's very variable. So some patients will get 6 months improvement. Some people will get a year. Some people will get less. And so ablative treatments like that have to be repeated, you know, as and when the bleeding starts to get worse again. And we did see a similar sort of pattern seen with systemic treatments like systemic Avastin, because it's a disease modifier, but only for as long as you are using it. So if you don't continue your maintenance treatment, you end up back at square one.
So you bring up a very good point, Will. In the study, it looked like there was several different dosing regimens. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so I think in the paper it's quite well outlined in terms of the combination of the dosing regimen. So I think the general thought process is that there needs to be an induction dose duration, which is usually around 3 months. And following this, there is a maintenance schedule. So this can be a continuous maintenance schedule where patients are brought in at regular schedules. But I think in real world application, potentially it's essentially a as required or intermittent maintenance dose that would be given to patients. And so essentially when they potentially feel that their bleeding is getting worse, or potentially their hematological parameters demonstrate that they're developing worsening anemia and so forth. So there was quite a variety of maintenance schedules provided in these studies. And there was one study that demonstrated that intermittent maintenance schedule actually resulted in worse ESS benefit compared to a continuous, which sort of does make sense if you think about it. But yeah, those were the findings.
Excellent. And so were there any studies, or do you know of any studies, Joe, where they combined it? You sort of alluded to how this may, you know, we take these patients back to the operating room to ablate these lesions. Is there another way where surgery could actually synergistically have better effects with the, you know, the Avastin along with surgery, or is this done completely in lieu of surgery?
No, so I think these trials were all just Avastin, and patients weren't allowed to have surgery while they were in the trials. But okay. in the real world, in real life, I have several patients who are, you know, they're getting worse despite regular lasers, or they're getting less and less duration of benefit after a laser. They will go on to Avastin. their symptoms will improve, but they will still need to come back for lasers. And it seems to be, it allows the effect of the laser to be maintained for longer. And from a personal point of view, the laser is much easier. The lesions are visibly smaller in many cases, and there's less bleeding sort of during the procedure as well. So I can tell a difference in the patients who have been having lasers before and then after Avastin, like their noses are different.
Oh, excellent. And you alluded to the potential side effects associated with topical application of Avastin. Are there, or did you see any side effects associated with the systemic utilization of Avastin?
Yep, so I can comment on that. And also something I wanted to answer the previous question about the concurrent use of surgical intervention and systemic treatment at the same time. I think it's important to note that a lot of the research groups driving the research of systemic bevacizumab are actually physicians, so hematologists, oncologists, and so forth. And in this systematic review, at least, I don't think they ever directly involved an otolaryngologist in these research papers. And in the methodology, another point that I raised was that sometimes they didn't include confounding factors such as using nasal humidification techniques, mentioning previous surgery that was done, or whether this was concurrently done. So potentially, you know, in the physician's mind, this was not something as important to discuss. But in reality, it is because, you know, our HHT surgeons, ENT surgeons do have to deal with this, and their treatment can also be confounding factors. So I think that's something important to note as well, and is a indication that in future research, we should they should really need to take this into account and have an otolaryngologist on board for the research. So just wanted to add that point. Yeah, so actually none of the papers mentioned septal perforation, which is, you know, a feared complication in the realm of HHT. I guess a lot of the case reports that discuss septal perforation in systemic bevacizumab are from oncology papers, and it's generally systemic bevacizumab is used in concurrent with chemotherapy, which has significant tissue toxicity effects. So we do think that it is different, especially when we're using lower doses of bevacizumab for HHT epistaxis. I believe it's 5 milligrams per kilogram compared to 10, 15, or even greater for cancer treatment. So I think it's not comparable, but for the limited evidence that we've found so far for this systematic review, there have been no septal perforations identified. And other side effects that have been identified were hypertension, proteinuria, which is less commonly reported, but no mortalities or other significant life-threatening adverse effects.
And the hypertension, how high can it go? Is it, you know, really high, or is it?
Yeah, so a few studies reported singular patients or a few patients having hypertensive urgency, meaning requiring urgent medical treatment for their hypertension. But this was, believed not something that was prolonged or resulted in any sequelae of cardiopulmonary complications.
Got it. So practically, Joe, what is your algorithm for treating epistaxis in patients with HHT?
So my algorithm really is the first time I meet them, I go through all of their options, and then I sort of give them the choice as to which they use and which they mix together to start with, at least. They're usually a very well-informed patient group. You know, many family members that they know, and they've seen them go through things, and that can sometimes be a help or a hindrance depending on what's happened to them. So I start off sort of with the conservative things that they can do at home, which is humidification and moisturizing therapies, nose oil, sesame oil. Some of them like using creams and oils and sprays in the nose, and others find that anything they put into their nose makes it bleed, so they prefer to leave it alone. And that's a very personal choice. The next step, if there's troubled enough to want to try and reduce the frequency and the severity of the bleeding, in my hands, is to offer them endoscopic laser ablation, which I do under a short day case general anesthetic. As I said earlier, that can be repeated, you know, as and when is needed. I wouldn't repeat it any more often than every 3 or 4 months, and I've only got a couple of patients who are that severe, and that's despite them being on Avastin, that they need it that often. Many patients can go for many more months than that.
Any particular favorite way to ablate the telangiectasias?
So I either use a KTP or a blue light laser. Okay. But they're both the same wavelength. So they're a red light 532 nanometer wavelength. And the rationale for that over sort of more normal standard cautery is that you don't cause a full thickness mucosal injury. And so you can ablate lesions on both sides of the septum simultaneously without increasing the risk of septal perforation.
Excellent. And then once they're having these fairly frequently, let's say once every 3 months, what are your next treatment options?
So the next treatment options, if it's predominantly, for example, the septum and it's on one side, or if it's predominantly septal lesions, then a septodermoplasty is a good option. So, you know, removing the septal mucosa and replacing it with a split thickness skin graft, which I take from the top of the thigh, because the skin is tough. It doesn't have telangiectasia on it from the thigh, and they can get a little bit crusty. But I've never had someone not come back to have the second side done, and I stagger them by 3 months. So the people that have it done like it enough to or think it's good enough that they'll come back and have the other side done.
Okay.
The skin graft does shrink over a period of time, sort of 5 years plus. And so occasionally it will be repeated after 5 years if it's been very helpful. If their lesions are more widespread and they're all at the lateral wall as well, then that's less of a good option, because although it was originally described by Saunders as a grafting the whole of the septum and the lateral wall, we actually don't do the lateral wall anymore. So the only definitive surgical treatment the only definitive treatment full stop for complete cessation of HHT related epistaxis is surgical closure of the nose, which I still do once or twice a year probably. And the rationale for that is that the nasal telangiectasia bleed due to the drying traumatic effect of airflow. If you remove the airflow, you remove the bleeding. The lesions are still there, but they don't bleed. And we wrote up, when I worked with Valerie Lund in London, we wrote up a series of 100 patients who'd all had nasal closure. There was about a 97% success rate. There was a few small pinholes opened up, and then they get a little bit of bleeding and you have to revise it. But the most important sort of points, which I tell patients, so that every single patient said they'd have it done again, and every single patient said they'd recommend it to somebody else with HHT.
Wow. And so when do you think about, you know, the systemic Avastin?
So I now think about it before or at the same time that I'm thinking nasal closure, because it's a big deal. It's a life-changing event, never being able to breathe through your nose again. And if I am offering it to a patient, I have a cohort of patients who are happy to speak to people considering it, because I can tell them how I do it, but I can't tell them what it's like to live with a closed nose.
Right.
But now that Avastin is a sort of a recommendation and is more readily available, then I do think about these systemic options at that point. So when the lasers are becoming less helpful, that's the time that I think about it. And I involve a hematologist at that point. Okay. If the patients are that severe, they usually have a hematologist of their own anyway. But I think these systemic antiogenic agents do have potential complications, although, as Will said, they're probably more related to the higher cancer doses that are given. But they're slightly prothrombotic in higher doses. There's a small risk of bowel perforation. There's the hypertensive crisis that can occur. So I do get a hematologist to go through all of the complications, and they are usually in a much better position with infusion centers to be able to actually give the treatment. Avastin is one of them. It was the first VEGF inhibitor available. There's a couple of oral ones becoming available, still not licensed for HHT alone. But there are a couple coming through that may make it easier for patients.
Oh, absolutely.
And then there's also some other things like thalidomide, which has anti-angiogenic properties, and everyone knows about thalidomide because of the catastrophe that happened when it was used for morning sickness. But it's very effective for HHT-related epistaxis. But it just causes a significant peripheral neuropathy, which patients generally can't tolerate after about a year.
Right. And then you alluded to just briefly, but when you take these patients for an ablation, sometimes you will apply a topical Avastin. Is that still the case, or how do you make that decision?
I make that decision on patient preference, because there is no strong evidence one way or the other. It's not part of my treatment regime. It's not a recommendation in the consensus guidelines. But if patients have either heard about it or they've had it before somewhere and they ask for it, then I will, I'll do it for them.
Okay. And what's the dosing that you usually will apply?
So we usually apply 50 milligrams, which comes in as 2 mils. So okay. We put it into each side of the nose. But again, all of the studies use variable dosing, anything from 10 milligrams up to 100. And so we plumped in the middle and gone for 50 milligrams.
That makes sense. All right. Well, that was awesome. Any last minute pearls? I feel like we've covered a lot.
I think we did. I think the probably the biggest thing is to make sure in these patients, as their epistaxis is getting worse, that they do have a hematologist, ideally managed through a centre of excellence, of which there are many in the US. We've just established one here in Melbourne at the Royal Melbourne Hospital. A hematologist is really invaluable, not only for regular iron infusions, but also once we do get to that point of considering systemic treatment.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you both for your time and insight tonight. I hope to run into you at an upcoming meeting. So thank you again. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us, Amber.
Bye-bye. Good night.
You're both long. Thank you for having us.